How do you want your character to die?
Welcome to the RPGpod.podcast. I'm Randall James, and I'm dying to be here. With me is Tyler Kamstra.
Hi, everybody.
And Random Pal.
No.
Yeah, that's random. And we have a special guest tonight. With us tonight is Wolf.
Oh, I thought you had it covered. Hi, my name's Wolf.
Perfect. Awesome. Awesome. Tyler, what are we doing tonight?
Today, we're going to talk about death. It's Halloween. Well, it's Spooktober, so it's the spooky month. We're going to talk about spooky things, and we wanted to start with death. Last week, we talked about the Monsterizer, so I guess technically we started with that, but you get my point. So we have Wolf here. Producer Dan and I met Wolf at PAX after a panel called The Care and Feeding of a Community. And Wolf had some really interesting insights into managing traumatic experiences for characters within a game, specifically death. Wolf, my understanding is you're very active in the local LARP community. And in live action roleplay, players often play the same character for years at a time. They've invested a lot of time and money into the character, into costumes, props, things like that. So death is really significant when you've really lived in a character for that long. And that feels very similar to the tabletop RPG experience, but taken like way to the extreme because you've spent so much time inhabiting this character.
It's true. I've seen it all. It's horrifying.
Well, hopefully not too horrifying. So you had some great insights in the panel about...
Well, actually, Tyler, before we go much further, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What is death?
What is death? Well, if we ask the biology community, question mark. I'm kidding. Scientists understand this way better than I do. So in terms of game terms, your character is dead. They go from a character to an object.
straight into the philosophical stuff. This is not what I was expecting from tonight. Good. Very good.
Truly a collection of objects, if we're being...
Yes. So depending on your rule set, there will be some variation on the rules that lead to your character dying. Most frequently, it will be you get hit with something nasty like a spell, or you take a bunch of damage and you're reduced to 0 hit points. Your character is now dying or possibly immediately dead. If you are a longtime RPG player, this has happened to you, most likely. If you're a new player, it's coming. Be ready and just understand it's part of the game. It might hurt. It probably should, but that's part of the experience.
Yeah, because in fifth edition, right, like we have this idea of the saving throws to save yourself from death, but you can actually take so much damage. Like, what is the rule? If you take a certain amount of damage, you're just dead. Like, it's over. You're gone.
Yeah, double your hit points. And that is way more, what am I trying to get at? Way more generous than previous editions. In 3.5, if you reached minus 10, you died. It doesn't matter if you're a 20th level character with 500 hit points. If you take 510 damage, you're dead. Pathfinder did that a little bit better. You could get to minus your con score for some reason, which still, you know, like I'm still 20th level. I still have 500 hit points. Ooh. Negative 520. Oh boy.
Yeah, the difference between 10 and 20 there isn't carrying much weight anymore, is it?
Exactly. So yeah, mechanical death, and there's usually some ways to save yourself from it. You know, in fifth edition, like Tyler said, you have your chance to save yourself with death saves, which is a really interesting mechanic. And particularly, it's kind of fun that you stop tracking hit points. If you're at zero, you're just dying, and even if somebody hits you for 50, you know, as long as that's not going to outright kill you, that's just one fail. Mechanical death like that. But yeah, character death, it's a can of worms.
Wolf, I've never done live action role play. So I'll ask the question, is there such a thing as mechanical death? What does it look like typically in LARP? Is there a particular system?
So it varies just sort of game to game. It is more hardcore games is pretty much one and done. When you have a bleed out timer. So once you've taken your damage or you've been hit in the appropriate spots, you fall over and you start a 5-minute counter. Then there's an option of a killing blow where they raise their arms and drop them down with their sword on you, and that cuts your timer down. And then there are games where when you die, you go to a resurrection circle and you draw beads from a bag and you have 8 beads and one of them is black. And if you draw the black bead, that's it, you're done.
Wow.
So there's a bunch of different systems, and that's just kind of the surface of the ones that I've played in.
How many not death beads do you have to draw to not be dead? Or is there some other mechanism to escape that?
7 are white, 1 is black. And if you draw a white bead, the white bead stays out of the bag. And the next time you die, you draw again, and your chances get even harder.
So it's not quite a 9 lives situation. And yeah, like you said, the odds get worse for you every single time.
I have seen new players draw the black bead on their first game.
Oh, that's rough. Oof. I actually really like that mechanic. That's so cool.
That's interesting. Like, I would almost want to take that into like regular games. We'll definitely come back to this later in the episode, but man, that is fascinating. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm imagining not doing this on Roll20 though, because I feel like I'm going to draw the black bead every single time. That's a whole nother.
Something about Roll20, our luck is just always the worst.
Yeah, at least mine. So I feel like we can kind of categorize deaths into 2 batches, right? There's the unplanned death. It's the, you made a bad choice or you got yourself into a bad situation. When we had Colby on a while back, they were saying, as a DM, killing your characters in 5e like is actually hard to do because the game is set up so well to keep players alive. I guess, especially in LARP, like, how often is it that a death is a planned death where it's like, look, we need to retire this character, we need to end this and kind of go to the next thing, versus, you know, live in-game dying?
Most of it is on camera. So it's happening live and in the moment. When deaths happen sort of outside of the public view or in private places, a lot of times the storytellers will get together with the player and say, let's make this cool. Let's do it in public. How do you want this to work? Ultimately, the ending is still the same. It's just we're letting you tell the story. We can choreograph a little bit and we can make it dramatic and fun for everyone, because nobody likes to die off screen.
Yeah, 100%. Like, how often is that like a character gets to redeem themselves and have this like heroic moment or something funny? How often is it like turning villainous and then being the foil right before being put down?
Honestly, in some of the games I play in, it's a roll of the dice. Somebody goes bad or somebody comes in with a concept where they're playing a villain, and sometimes both will get their moment. Your heroic person is he's saving someone, and the villainous PC is he's getting stabbed by the heroic PC. And so really it's a roll of the dice. I'd say by far the most dangerous thing is going into the woods alone is probably one of the most dangerous situations, where you get murdered by a monster in the woods because you went out there alone.
Makes sense.
It's funny, right? So you talk about going off in the woods alone, the eternal trope of don't split the party. Having characters turn villainous, sometimes against their own will, like against the player's will, can be a really interesting way to just throw a wrench into the current narrative, which, if you're prepared for it, can be really cool. There's various points that I've seen in books and even experienced, like, everyone is asleep, but the person on watch, and the person on watch fails a geese, and now they're secretly plotting to kill you. Source, this happened to me. If you are going to roll something like that, I think that it's really important to talk with the player. If it is something that is happening live, like, okay, the randomness says you failed your geese, you're my spy now, or you failed, you know, the dominate, whatever, then play out the rest of the session and then talk to this person offline, you know, say, all right, I know you love this character. I own you at this point. We need to figure out how to make this interesting so that maybe this character does die. Maybe this character can be redeemed somehow. It's a thing to be aware of that you should play out the immediate consequences, but don't feel like you're locked into those immediate consequences. For, you know, just because this person has suffered the Vargwheel's kiss, they are now toast because they're a level 2 character. Talk to somebody, and then if you are going to plan it, then definitely have that sort of plan for making it be something cool.
Yeah, I guess I want to like dive into this a little bit more. So I've never been in a situation where there's a planned character death where a DM and a player are like conspiring together to put this together. And so, Wolf, for what you talk about for LARPing, when it is a plan, how do you do that? Do you put the high-level bullets together and then kind of get from bullet to bullet as improv? Like, how much of this is scripted and rehearsed versus we know we want to get to this endpoint, so just get out there and get there?
If someone's retiring their character, say they're getting close to an XP cap, which is something that they do in a lot of LARPs to help with the power creep and stuff, we'll spend a lot more time, you know, choreographing what's going to happen, what's happened with their character in the last year, 2 years, 3 years that led them up to this point. And then we work with them to tell the story and to help push the plot forward. Generally, from the get-go on character creation, it's one of the things I talked about at PAX. One of the questions we like to ask and continually ask is, how do you want your character to die? It's interesting to see how much that answer changes as the character develops, because at first they may say, you know, I want to go in the tavern when it's caught on fire, you know, and that's how I want to go. And then later on, it's like, I want to die in the arms of this person who saved me. And it also serves as a mechanism to remind them that death is a possibility, especially in LARPs where you play for 2 or 3 years. You forget, you've gone in the woods 100 times, you're safe. Like you every time, 10 out of 10. And then that one time that rock golem comes out and smashes you for 100 massive damage and you're down and you're in the woods and nobody's there. It's so, sorry, getting off topic, but in retirement situations or in situations that are like a character wanting to bring in something else, they will generally talk to staff, work something out that continues the plot or seeds the next plot or makes the villain look even more, you know, badass. In smaller scale situations, like if I'm going out as a big bad guy NPC and I accidentally throw 100 massive at that poor new player it's his second game, I create workarounds with the player where I pick their body up while they're still on their 5-minute count and I walk them into town and I throw their body at the tavern. And then all their friends come out, fight me and kill me like they're supposed to. And then they have the chance to save their buddy. So in those situations, it's a little less choreographed and more like, I'm going to drag you in here because you shouldn't have been out here and you likely didn't know.
No, that's pretty awesome.
I like that kind of, I don't want to say gentleness because it's not quite that. Throwing an unconscious body into the tavern as a monster feels plausible, but at the same time, it does provide those interesting guardrails for new players. I think that's a really clever way to handle that.
And in other situations, we'll turn them undead. You know, we'll raise them as undead, which stops their counter. Now they're temporarily an NPC. We get to send them in. Everyone knows what's happening. And then they get to murder him and raise him back to life. So it's another option to make it a little more thematically appropriate.
Revenants revivify. No. God, why? It's back. It's back in LARP.
Okay. Random. No, there are going to be people asking what that is. You got to explain that one.
I know. So the undeath that you just talked about. So in Dungeons & Dragons 3.5, so Revivify, much like Revivify in 5th edition, if someone has recently died, you bring them back to life, no penalty. It's a lower level and it's way easier to accomplish. Great. But what do you do if someone's been dead for a day because you didn't have Revivify? Well, you blame Wizards of the Coast for wording things badly because they created this spell called Revenants, which is basically, I'm going to bring someone back to life from the dead so that I can talk to them for like 15 minutes. And then, and this is the exact wording of the spell, at which point they die again. And because they just died, they are now a valid target for Revivify. And so you bring them back to life. And you can't see my frantic arm gestures, podcast listeners, but oh my God, Watsy. Figure yourself out.
They were vivacious. I will say for the LARP situation, that sounds perfect to me, because I can imagine you might have folks who were out there for their first time. They will walk away not realizing that you saved their life, potentially. They might just think, that was awesome, because like I went out there and I got murdered, and then he threw me at my friends. Idiot. Because then my friends brought me back to life. Like I can imagine a situation where they learned the lesson you want them to learn, which is you can die in this game. Don't just gently walk out into the night because you think it's going to be a good time. But also, they still get to come back and play that same character without having to restart. So that really makes a lot of sense to me.
And when you have, you know, 50 to 120 or 200 players at a time, the power scale is more difficult to manage. So like in D&D, generally, you're close to the same level as you progress. Nobody wants to be that guy who shouldn't be in the universal like domain of planes as level 2 because he's going to get killed by a scrap piece of dust. So we've got people from level 2 all the way up, you know, 110 that are out there playing. And the one guy who thinks he's safe in the woods gets found because he doesn't know that he shouldn't be there. And just to be clear, rock golems are very territorial and like to rip people apart in front of other people to show how badass they are.
It's the kind of monster that'll beat a dude with another dude.
Yeah, Rock Golem X.
So in LARP, like how, you know, you talked about throwing the body at a group of friends. how attached to a particular character will other characters be? Like, do they, is it a thing folks take in stride, or do they really get into the role play of like, you know, it's John and John's gone and I can't believe this.
Artemis, it's real bad.
Wait, you, which way? Because there's so many versions of real bad.
You get really attached to your character. We have some players in a couple of the games that I play with who have an accent and they can't stop speaking with the accent. You're almost guaranteed to have dreams or nightmares about your character dying or living within the first year of playing. And people get really attached. And there are funerals that people hold in character. Generally, there are safe places where you can speak out of character. But once you're in the game space area, you're considered in character for all intents and purposes, unless you're brand new and don't know the rule yet. There are decorum calls. So if somebody starts speaking about the real world and cell phones and all of this, you just politely say decorum and it's the call to get them back on track.
Oh, well, obviously not from the LARP perspective. I have not done much of that, but even just like a regular D&D game, I have definitely had characters, you know, more and less, and it's really about the character, I think. You know, is a chaotic neutral stabby rogue gonna be real mournful about the passing of other people? Nah, man, that's money laying on the ground. On the other hand, this paladin that I have talked about so often, we lost two player characters to the final boss of Death House. A few sessions later, when we finally got some downtime, in between sessions, I found a font that claimed to be giant, like, you know, which is like based on a dwarven script. I wrote out the character names and I printed them, brought them in, and I said, hey, other character, will you ritual scar these into my back for me? And that way I was carrying those, you know, dead characters with me forever. You know, that's really where, you know, how long should the PCs mourn? It's dependent on the person, right? In the same way that people in real life, you know, you're going to have people who react to death very differently. You're going to have somebody who says, well, yep, there went my parents, woo. Or you're going to have somebody who is really grieving, and if they're processing for days, weeks, months, that's fine. Now, you know, given the nature of D&D, you're probably not going to be actually IRL mourning a character for months, but it's also plausible. So it just boils down to, what do you think the character that you're inhabiting would do as a reaction to these other characters dying?
I'm curious what you guys think. If the death of the character isn't planned, like, does that affect kind of that mourning period? I know I've had some characters that I was kind of attached to die untimely deaths. Random, your Rise of the Runelord campaign, I had the same character die at least twice. The first time, real unplanned. It was a straight up fight. We were winning. I got hit with a bad critical hit and went from like half hit points to outright dead in one shot. And I was the healer, so nobody else was going to do anything to help me. Yeah, so if the death is unplanned, but also inevitable, like, how do you handle that?
I think that, once again, I'm going to want to point us towards, let's have a social solution first. And part of that is going to be, at your session zero, setting the expectation of, this is a low, medium, high lethality campaign. You know, we talked about this summon failure, because often, you know, consequences for failure do lead to death. Maybe your characters aren't actually dead, but improvise and they're captured. Or maybe, like, yeah, you're dead, but people are going to be able to bring you back to the local cleric who very conveniently you have done a service for and will bring you back to life. Or maybe it is just, nah, man, you died. And again, like we talked about in an episode, I think there's really a lot of, did you die because you're a wizard who just walked into a room full of territorial rock golems? Or did you die because, like, we were having a straight up fight and, man, I crit you three times in a row. I'm sorry, that's on me. When is it acceptable? I think really you're going to want to start off with having that conversation long before it comes up. As long as you stick to that. And in fact, in my personal opinion, you should even oversell how lethal your game is going to be a little bit, so that then you can tone it back. So that, you know, if you say somebody is really attached to their character and you are just about to murder them, it's like, oh, you 33 hit points? Oh, that's weird. He deals you 31 damage. ignores dice. On the one hand, talk about it ahead of time so that people know. And on the other hand, if the numbers say that it should happen, make it happen and then talk about it with the player afterwards if you can tell that they are really broken up about it.
So there's an interesting thing here, though, that you've highlighted, and then Wolf, I think you also highlighted in the LARP context. It does feel a bit arbitrary whether as a game master you're going to say, no, you're dead and you're dead permanently, or I'm going to give you an out through a local cleric or through this in-game mechanism where your teammates, your friends can help you. Where, Wolf, I heard you apply earlier, if it's your first game or if you're very new to this, I'm actually going to cut you some slack, but I'm going to cut you some slack for in a way that actually makes sense in the game. And there's probably a point where you cut that off where you said, okay, look, you've been here for months. You knew. Sorry. And again, like how far in a campaign, if it's our third session in a game, maybe I'm okay with killing your player character because it's not like you're attached to it anyway. We'll roll a new character and you'll do better next time. But if it's a year into the campaign and I crit you in this amazing way that nobody expected, that's much harder to manage.
Yeah, I super agree. Generally, you get some games do the first two deaths are free, where you don't have to draw from the bag. You just go back to the resurrection circle. Some games, they're a little bit more lenient. I think it's two or three game sessions that you get to play. And then some of them is just, I brought a machine gun to a knife fight. I didn't know the guy in the woods was going to have like a knife and a box of tissues that he's too dead to use. And so I got to make a correction for that. Generally, when I'm playing tabletop and other running games like that, I put a level cap on, and it is about managing expectations. I say, you know, by level 5, my common sense should be your common sense. The world should be explained enough that you have a general understanding of how things work. At that point, I take the gloves off and let the dice do the work.
I think that's the right way to handle things, depending on the level scale. Like your 20-level D&D game, if you're starting level 1 and you make it to level 5, by then you've probably got a pretty good sense of how things work and how lethal things are going to be. Wolf, you mentioned that there were LARPs that go up to, I think you said level 110, something like that?
Yeah, depending on the game that you're playing, you can go all the way up to... I have a level 341 rogue in one of the games I play in. And I only play with the new players because I like to teach them how to be real fighters in real life and then send them off into the game as amazing rogues at level 2. There's something about seeing a bunch of, I call them ducklings, sneak up behind the big monster, do like 60 damage, and then bleed into the shadows in real life. It makes my heart throb. I love it.
That's great. Just for curiosity, so you're level 300 something. How quickly do you advance levels in that game?
I ran one of the chapters for 2 years. And so I invested my payment in that game, which is an imaginary payment that doesn't do anything in real life. But I reinvested that into blanket XP because they're national games. So basically it's like I pretended to play in this game over here that I would have pretended to be my character. So I get XP for playing that. But the progression is... it's almost twice as difficult to get to the next level. So it would take probably 5 years to get level 200, level 250. And that's like playing every single game that you can get to locally, like the Washington, Oregon, and maybe the California game, just to try to maximize the amount of experience points you're getting.
Wow. Okay. So you're super invested in this character then.
Yeah. I'm tempted to ask, under what scenario will that character die?
Oh, I want him to die. He has yet to pull a bead from a bag. He doesn't believe that resurrection is okay. And he absolutely hates magic in all forms. He thinks if you were civilized, you just stab somebody in the back like everyone else. So my answer to my own question for that character was, I want to die telling my party that if we do this, we're going to die. And having done that, I will be the one to die while making direct eye contact with my party that I told we shouldn't do this. I want that.
So you want to see it coming. Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Well, it's more than that. You want the last imprint you give to them to be guilt.
Absolutely.
Everlasting shame.
Yeah. I want them to think the next time they're going to the bathroom, like, am I going to die? Would he say that I was going to die? And I mean, since sometimes going to LARPs, you have to leave your cabin and physically walk to the bathroom. to go to the bathroom, and that's a place where NPCs jump you. I myself have camped outside looking for someone doing the pee-pee dance. Like, I want that to be that moment where you're like, what would he say? He would say, don't go outside, you're going to die. Like, I want it to haunt him, you know?
Now, again, just curiosity, because I still haven't made it to a LARP despite being invited numerous times. So the restrooms are in character too?
No. So once you're inside the bathroom, so I'm speaking about different sites. I own one, but I'll talk about that later. You typically sleep in a cabin, and the bathrooms are like on a campsite. They're not in the same building. So you have to walk sometimes up to a quarter of a mile to get to the bathroom. And them's woods is dangerous, especially in the middle of the night when you're like, I'm going to leave all my stuff here because this is an emergency. I need to get there right now. And then you're running through and you see that giant rock golem and you're just like, just kill me so I can go to the bathroom out of character, please. Like, I want to go.
Wonderful.
Okay. Is the cabin where you're sleeping also a safe place?
Different games have different rules. Okay. I would say generally from 2 a.m. to 8 a.m., you're safe sleeping in your cabin. No monsters are going to come in. But as far as PvP goes, it's whatever you want. Somebody comes into your cabin and shanks you in the night and it's another PC. Rough. But as far as PvE goes, we generally stop at 2 a.m. But I absolutely have crawled into people's bed with them at like 8:15 in the morning as a fae and been like, Josh, wake up. And then hit them with some hallucinate gas and run away.
Can we just crop that and just slip that in at the beginning of the episode? Just to mess with anyone listening named Josh.
Oh my God,
that is wonderful.
I'm imagining having to actually set guard like before we go to sleep. Like,
you really do have to set a watch.
I need you to be awake for this.
Oh my gosh, that's so much fun.
Yeah, the worst thing that's ever happened to me is like I got attacked by the cat once when I was going to get a beer, but that was my fault.
Yeah, that's the trouble of owning a cat.
All right, so let's say I'm that guy. It's 4 a.m. I wake up, run to the restroom, get ambushed by the rock golem. And at the time, I'm like, look, man, just kill me and I'm going to go do this and we'll deal with the consequences later. And then I wake up the next morning and think, maybe I made the wrong choice. Maybe I still want to be this character. How do we recover from that?
That depends on the game you're playing and the rule set going in. So you'll be able to manage your expectations from there. Obviously, there are some caveats for it's 4 a.m. and I had to go pee. And that's definitely something that most plot members will definitely have that conversation with you. It's generally accepted that you're going to be frustrated, especially getting up in the middle of the night and having to go to the bathroom first off and then being jumped by a rock monster. Man, nobody really saw that coming. I guess running into a bunch of traps would probably be a whole different conversation because we use like little mouse traps that signify that you've hit a trap. And that might be a conversation that you save for the morning and then walk up to we call it monster camp, the place where the logistics team get together and do horrible things to the players. You know, it would be up to them. They would say, okay, you accidentally ran into 3 traps going to the bathroom. All right, let's have this conversation. And in a lot of cases, they'll have you go out into an area in the woods and just lay down and start your counter then. And when somebody comes up to ask you what happened, you tell them that a rock monster jumped out of nowhere. And that was that. Some games have a fate of the party rule where I'm sleeping out of character. Anything that happens after I go to sleep, I leave my body, which is a physical character sheet, in this cabin. And whatever happens, happens to the party. And that's, I've always felt that's the more dangerous scenario because if they decide to go Leroy Jenkins or something, then you went with them. And next thing you know, it's dude, where's my car? As you're trying to figure out what happened to your body.
I will say, I'm imagining being the rock column, the NPC, but the player part of it, that's just camping outside the bathroom waiting for people who have to pee. Yeah. It's like the troll waiting under the bridge. It's like, who pees here? Yeah, anyway. Okay.
I myself have been in a full ghillie suit, hiding near the bathroom, just into the shadows, waiting with an herb that you pick in real life. You have to walk around the woods and find the herbs. Planted in my chest, waiting for people who are going to the bathroom but decide to come over and pick the herb on the way to the bathroom and then get them.
That's amazing. What herb is this? I'm so curious.
So if you have herbalism, and typically we use prop flowers, and it's got a little QR code on it, depending on your skill level, when you scan it, it'll tell you what the herb is. And so they don't really know until they get close enough to find out.
Okay, so it's like a game herb, not like a real world herb that correct. You're actually... Okay.
There is a physical representation of the herb that is a fake flower with a QR code on it. But when they come up to check and the tree is alive, it sort of goes downhill from there.
If they haven't gone yet, they will then.
Yes, definitely. Yeah,
absolutely. That's amazing.
Okay. And so I feel like we've talked about the different ways in LARP that folks will come back to life. So the beads, I think we've all agreed, is probably the best idea on this that we've ever heard. That sounds amazing. The idea that if you're dead, you're dead. I mean, this is always something that's there. I guess I want to bring it back to 5e for a second. I have either failed my saving throws, my death saving throws, or I have taken so much damage that I am just dead. In 5th edition, what are my options to actually come back to life?
So I did touch on one of them a little bit ago. Traditionally, divine magic is going to get you stuff like revivify, raise dead, resurrection, reasonably certain they removed true res in this edition. And because at this point, you could probably just miracle, which it's the same level, so why not? There are definitely several ways of someone casts a spell and you come back to life. It is almost invariably going to involve crumbling up some diamonds because I don't know why. I guess they're pure, and so that purifies your corpse or something, question mark.
It's because we all know there's a value to life, and that value is diamonds.
Materialism in my D&D, it's more likely than you think. All of these spells are something that kind of become a problem as the game goes on, because, you know, when you are a lower level and somebody dies, you're just dead, unless the DM feels like being generous. But at higher levels, and we talked about this again some in the failure episode, it can really feel like death is cheapened by the fact that, great, I have a million money because I'm a level 15 character and I have all of these spell slots. And so, oh, somebody died. Anyway, carry on. You know, that Jeremy Clarkson meme of, oh no, anyway.
Yeah.
We talked some as well about like what we would do to fix this. I love that idea of the bags with, you're going to get up to 8, perhaps, resurrections if you are exceedingly lucky. Matt Mercer's resurrection rules, where if someone tries to cast one of these spells, it is not just a guaranteed success. There's a roll that happens that can be modified by other members of the party doing other things that are perhaps relevant to the character. One of the things that I will reiterate from when I talked about it that time is it can be a really cool way to find out what other characters, what other players as their characters think is meaningful to your character, which is a really cool way to gauge like how well have you been role-playing. In any case, if you succeed in the ritual in Matt Sparser's rules, or if you just cast the spell in rules as written D&D, eventually someone knocks on your dead soul and says, hey bro, you want to come back to your body? That's another interesting thing, because you know, if you're at a real hardcore roleplay table where maybe the player hasn't been talking because they've been dead, maybe they didn't want to be that character anymore. Maybe you knock on their soul and the soul says, nah, I'm good. I'm up here chilling in Celestia with my god who I've been worshiping for my entire life. I'm going to stay.
Yeah. The real world sucks.
And D&D, yeah, kind of.
A bit. I've always kind of wondered that, like, you're a lawful good character, you worship a good aligned deity, you die, you go to heaven, things are pretty great there. And someone casts Raise Dead, it's like, am I going to leave heaven and go, I don't know, fight zombies in a dirty pit?
And this is why you don't give them a chance and you just resurrect them for the God Claw.
Although I can spin that on you, right? Like if you truly are a lawful good and you believe you were doing good in the world, that eternal reward is always going to be there. You might as well come back and do a little bit more good. And then you go and you do that.
See, say that. I'm going to go back to Random's reference to the God Claw. That is a very specific reference. Random's Rise of the Rune Lord campaign that I was in for, gosh, how long was I in that game? Well over a year. So I started as a lawful good paladin, died on the end of a pitchfork, and then came back as a lawful neutral oracle dedicated to the God Claw, which is a lawful organization of deities who don't like each other very much, but very much like to continue existing, if I remember correctly. Yeah. So character was very much brought back to life against their will with the duty to do. So sometimes you do come back from the dead against your will, and that can be a really interesting character point. And as much as I love that character, honestly, I think I kind of flopped on the role playing that.
And one thing that I want to be clear here, Tyler and I had this conversation that this character was going to come back outside the game. This is something that, you know, I offered him a chance, like, you know, you do love this character. If you want to come back, you can come back. I'm going to make some changes. I'm going to do this. This is not something that you should foist on your player. Don't ever make someone play a character they don't want to be playing. That is just going to breed resentment, and no one will have fun. I promise you that. So
yeah. So this is a place you took the social cure.
Exactly. Yeah. To you. And it's the same thing that I offered to everyone in that game, which everyone except one person took me up on. The first time they died, that campaign lasted nearly 3 years. So over the course of that game, I did kill every single player at least once. It's Rise of the Runelords is epic. It is like 1 to 18. Each of them got that same choice, which again was handled in the social fashion. You know, it's like, okay, here's this option. If you want it, great. If not, roll up another character. And 4 of the 5 players took me up on, yeah, I want to come back. They were really invested in the characters. So it's just a way of gauging like if someone really does want to play or not.
So I do have one more question about death, specifically in 5th edition. Are there situations like, do you have to have a body to be resurrected? So if my body is burned to death, or I'm tossed in a volcano, or I'm frozen and unrecoverable at the bottom of a lake, can I still be resurrected?
It depends on the spell. Raise dead requires a body. More powerful spells might not. You might need a portion of the body, which it's not always clear how big that portion needs to be. So like, when your characters start getting high enough level that that's an option, it's a real good idea to leave your own hair various places. Just wake
Everybody
up in the morning.
Hand a hand yourself, brush over.
Yeah. Yes. Brush your hair, hand it to the cleric and be like, all right, we're good. I've got insurance.
The one bald monk is just sitting here like...
That's fine. I'll see your nail clippings. Yeah.
Just leave him dead. It's fine.
I'm sorry for that suggestion.
You should be. I want to go back to LARPing for a second. So we talked about a few different mechanisms for somebody to come back to life. What are the other player characters' options for bringing somebody to back to life? So if somebody has their 5-minute timer has expired, are all other players out of it and there are no other options?
Once your timer has expired, your options are to go to the resurrection circle. That's generally most deaths or downs, I guess you might call them, happen in an active battlefield where there are a bunch of people running around and there are dedicated healers. So when you're down, somebody might come up and they have a 10-second incant where they have to incant their healing spell and then touch you with a packet, and then you come back to life and they try to drag you off of the battlefield and keep you from dying. Once you hit your death counter is when you're technically dead, and in that 5 minutes players can save your life. But after that, you do go to the resurrection circle.
You have mentioned this several times, this resurrection circle. What is that? What is the mechanic there?
The mechanic is there's an actual glowing circle. On our site, we have a graveyard, but there's a big lit up glowing blue circle, and your body sort of reconstitutes there without any of your gear, just your clothes, because, you know, legal reasons. And you can't leave the circle. Someone who is attuned to that type of magic has to come and give you permission to leave that circle. Once you do, you have to go find your gear and you come back after your bead draw. And I've had people run in with literally just a dagger in their hand, no armor, no anything, run right back into battle. And it was probably a half mile run that they took from the resurrection circle back to the battle.
Wow, that is dedication.
Serious Dark Souls vibes. Anyway.
Is that indication of a really good player or really crazy player? Dark Souls, who knows? Yes, great answer.
Although, yeah, I would totally do the Dark Souls LARP. That sounds great. Like I have an ever growing like bag of fruit that I have to carry around, and if ever I die twice, I lose all my fruit.
We should definitely talk after this. We got one for you.
Okay. How's that Skyrim meme go? It's like fighting a dragon and just eat 12 wheels of cheese.
you don't do that?
I mean, I do, but I do that not even just fighting. I do that just because cheese.
Awesome. All right. Awesome, Mossman. I think we did it. I think that's a whole episode. All right. This week, we have a question of the week. Our question of the week comes from Pugmonz, or perhaps PugmonZZ. I'm not exactly sure. Which class in 5e is most in need of a rework?
Oh, that's a hard question. I'm going to say Monk. Fifth edition Monk does a lot of things really well that it has kind of struggled with in previous editions. Random and I are natives of third edition, where the Monk was just straight up garbage. So fifth edition's Monk being actually playable is really awesome. It would be nice if there was more than one way to play a Monk. Every Monk you're ever going to play is going to be Dexterity first, Wisdom second. Maybe Astral Self can get away with Wisdom first and then Dexterity second. But like, that's the only options. The only change between builds is your subclass, and some variety there would be great.
Yeah. And for those listening at home, the entire time that Tyler was talking, Random was shaking or nodding his head extremely vigorously.
Having played a Monk in both editions, 3.5 and 5th edition, or I know I played several in 3.x. I also landed on that before he said anything. If you gave it a year and a half ago, I would have said Ranger, but then Tasha's came out and did a good job of giving us some fixes. It's interesting at this point, like how much the power level of your game hinges on, do I own / allow this book? Because, you know, in especially in more recent things, as you start getting better and better subclasses and fixes to things, Ranger is just bad prior to Tasha's. And even in 3.5, it was very similar. If you wanted to be a character that used a bow, you should be a fighter. And there was literally no point to playing a Ranger. As a fighter, if you spent all of your fighter bonus feats on getting good with a bow, you'd be better with a bow than a Ranger. And then you can spend your regular feats on getting good at skills. And congratulations, you're a better Ranger as a fighter.
No, but I want to be Strider with a gaggling of hobbits like following behind me.
Honestly, we're not going to get into how the internet argues about whether or not Gandalf is a 20th level fighter with a high int. But I'm glad. I still think that fighter could use a lot. I still think that Ranger could use a lot of work. You know, we talked about this a little in the optimization that the Crash Course episode. It feels like they really tried to split the difference between a rogue and a fighter, and they did it really badly. 3.5 introduced the scout class in Complete Adventurer, which was also a much better ranger and felt like a ranger than a ranger. I'm glad. And I think that at this point, I would have to agree with Tyler, like it's Monk, but Ranger, man, yikes.
Did they ever fix the artificer? Because that was awful. I had the worst time playing. It was like I was somebody's pocket helper who would hand them stuff. And then I spent the rest of my time sitting, literally trying not to die, getting as far away from combat as possible.
Oh boy, did they ever fix artificer?
Yeah. Okay.
If you haven't gone and read my guide that is a love letter to armor artificer, you should. That class is so good in fifth edition with its full release and Tasha's. It can do literally anything you want it to, including being just one subclass, depending on how you choose, being either probably the best tank in the game or probably the best scout in the game, just like with no other additions. It's so good.
Yeah, 5e artificers are nuts.
You say Tasha's. I thought the artificer came out in Eberron, or was it like an expansion of the class came out in Eberron?
It was originally in Eberron Rising from the Last War and then republished in Tasha's. They periodically republish things from setting specific books because they know not everyone's going to buy the Eberron book just for one class. Yeah.
Okay. That makes good sense. That makes good sense. Awesome.
Yeah. The fifth edition artificer is really, really great, but really, really complicated.
Nice. And so, Wolf, it sounds like we need to get you into a 5e game where you can take one more swing at an artificer, or maybe you would run fleeing from that class and try anything else.
I liked it. It was a lot of interesting role play. And I worked my way into a position where they needed to keep me alive, but I spent almost all of combat kind of just getting out of the way. I have nothing to compare it to. It was very strange to be almost completely useless in combat.
That is strange.
I want to take one slight hot take here for a second. I think maybe the class that needs the most rework is a wizard, because if wizard is consistently the strongest class in every edition, you need to balance it. I don't know how we would fix that, but spellcasting.
Yeah, counterpoint. Nah.
So
they don't call it Sorcerers of the Coast, I guess.
So my thing with wizard is always the strongest class in D&D, but it's, I don't think I've explained this before on the podcast, but there's a concept of a skill floor and a concept of a skill ceiling. So the floor is like how proficient you need to be successful in a thing. And the skill ceiling is how high you can go in that thing and how awesome you can be at it. Wizards have a really high skill ceiling. The skill floor in 5th edition is actually surprisingly low because a lot of the subclasses are super easy to play. If you just stick to blowing stuff up, everything's going to be fine. Artificers are similar, super high skill ceiling, but they also have a really high skill floor because if you're not proficient with the game, the artificer is super intimidating. But the wizard rewards system mastery, and that's why it's always been my favorite class. If you understand the system, if you understand the options, if you understand the play style, like the more you know about the game, the more the wizard rewards you. And personally, I don't want anyone to take that away from me because I'm selfish like that. But to some degree, yeah, the wizard probably shouldn't always be the strongest class. And real quick, the question of the week wasn't specific to 5th edition, so I'm going to answer for Pathfinder 2nd edition as well. So far, having read through every class that has been published, including Guns and Gears, so far, I really like all of the classes. I don't think there's any real losers right now. There are specific options within classes that have problems. I know the mutagen-focused alchemist from the core rulebook has some problems that they've tried to patch with errata, and that could use a little bit of work. Honestly, I think Pathfinder 2nd Edition did a really good job with the class design. And since it's so dependent on feats over like subclasses and stuff, even if one class is falling behind, it's really easy to fix with like, okay, here's two or three new feats for that class and everything is fine. Yeah, 5th Edition, Monk, maybe Ranger, Don't Touch My Wizard, Pathfinder 2e, everything's pretty great.
Real quick, it's fascinating that they did that because mutagen alchemists were actually pretty good in the first Pathfinder. So interesting that that's one of the weakest things. Just a shower thought.
Yeah, my understanding is some things changed last minute from the second edition playtest to the final publication. And like they forgot to cross a couple of T's and dot a couple of I's and things broke by accident. But I mean, other than that, yeah, class design in 2nd edition is really good.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you, Pugmon ZZ, for your question. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So, and also thank you for joining us on episode 9, the 10th episode of RPGBot.podcast. Next episode, we're going to be talking about making horror work at a tabletop game. So how do we do horror in tabletop? I'm Randall James. You can find me at amateurjack.com, Jack Amateur on Twitter and Instagram.
I'm Tyler Kamster. You can find me at rpgbot.net. You can find me on Twitter at rpgbotdotnet. Same for Facebook. And you can find me on patreon.com/rpgbot.
And I'm Rand Appel. You won't generally find me on social media, but in places where people play games, I am often there as Harlequin or Harlequint. But mostly you'll find me here contributing to the podcast and articles on rpgbot.net.
I'm Wolf, and you can find us at seattlelarpsite.com or Facebook. /middleground.
Awesome. All right. All hail the Leisure Illuminati. Thank you, producer Dan. You'll find affiliate links for source books and other materials linked in the show notes. Following these links helps us to make this show happen every week. So please do it. You'll find our podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. If you enjoy this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe and share it with your friends. If you're interested in LARP, I think we'll put some resources in the show notes so you could kind of follow along with that and find an opportunity to get involved. And if you know anybody who needs this podcast in their lives, please share. If your question should be the question of the week next week, please email podcast@rpgbot.net or message us on Twitter at rpgbotdotnet. If your monster should be the monster of the week next week, please email us at, or no, don't do that. Do this. Tweet us at Twitter at RPGBOTDOTNET hashtag Monsterizer. I know we announced this last week. The Monsterizer is a fantastic tool, and we have our first Monster of the Week, and we're super excited to talk about it. This comes to us from Bearded Pilgrim, and I think, quote, he said, "I'm sorry, I'm not sorry." He created Rocket Rhino.
Amazing.
It is wonderfully exactly like you might imagine. It's a rhinoceros. It flies. It also is apparently the helicarrier from the Avengers and has like retroreflective panels, which is amazing. What wonderful piece of creativity that someone decides, you know what this rhinoceros needs? Jetpack. It's a jetpack.
Obviously.
Yeah, it's so good. Like the little details, like immune to being knocked prone. Why?
Because it flies. This is a conversation that maybe we'll have when we do the episode talking about flight. So it is preposterous to me that in some editions, I don't know if this carries over into fifth edition, if you are flying, you can still be knocked prone, which still imposes the prone condition, which is absurd because you're flying.
Like, basically, my understanding of it is if you're knocked prone while flying, you just begin to fall.
Yeah. So the number one way to counter flight is trip.
Yeah, apparently. But I want to point out something that really caught my eye on this. Under languages, it says understands, but can't speak. It doesn't say what language it understands. It just says understands.
Now, as the person who wrote the Monsterizer, as the person who built the Monsterizer, that is either a bug, or I think they may have just put an empty, like a space into the languages
field. Or maybe it was intentional.
Maybe it was
intentional. And this Rocket Rhino, it knows every single language in existence. It just can't speak, which is amazing to me.
Because it's a rhinoceros.
I'm sorry. What a great way to build fear. Here is the rhinoceros. It understands you. It can't speak.
But it understands you.
But it understands you. And now it's going to rocket charge you.
Yeah. I do. So the retroreflectors thing, just to be clear, right? When perceived from below, Rocket Rhino gains a plus 10 bonus to stealth. Okay.
So that is a bonus.
In this world, we are out. You know, we're in the city. We're not in the savannah. Rocket Rhino obviously lives in the city. You see something in the distance. All of a sudden, you see a flash as something disappears in the air, but you look up and you see nothing because there's a rhinoceros flying over your head about to kill you, but it has sky camouflage.
This creature actually reminds me of a meme creature from a game of my youth called Age of Mythology. If you put in cheat code that said Wuv-woo. It would create a flying hippopotamus purple that would shoot hearts and rainbows at enemies. And it was lovely, and he was my favorite little boy, and I loved him.
That is wonderful.
Man. Nice. All right, so we're going to have to say, at Bearded Pilgrim, thank you very much for what you've given us.
Gift.
You have the Monster of the Week.
Hell yeah.
I think we did it. Good job, everyone.
Nobody died during the death episode. The best.